Welcome, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 9. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Squepmakulu, the stolen ancestral and unceded lands of the Squepmak people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Now, much of the time, the word policy sounds abstract, neutral, distant, something to do with ideas and government and law, but not something personal. Yet every organized gathering of people in the world, from local neighborhood stamp clubs right up to the national government or United Nations, has a set of policies that govern its behavior. From rules about personal conduct to guidelines about managing meetings to determining who gets paid and how much, it is policies that determine how much of how we interact with one another. Just think of something so important as a universal pension plan for seniors, or Medicare, or the way the RCMP officer speaks to you on the street, or the responsibilities of the mayor in your community. Every one of these situations and behaviors and structures and actions or roles is shaped by one or often many policies, a set of rules and instructions for describing what to do in each of these situations. When Jane Philpott was the Federal Minister of Health, she recounts in her book Health for All how with the stroke of a pen she could positively affect the lives of thousands of people, improving their health, improving access to health services, just making their lives better. The tool for bringing about this change was a new policy. Policies that affect an entire country are critically important. Our guest today on Food Conversations is someone who's played a key role in establishing and improving food policy in the entire country of Canada, and indirectly, because of today's interconnected world, in the rest of the planet. The name of the organization which she helped to found is PROOF, P-R-O-O-F, and its purpose is to gather solid and detailed evidence for the best policy to establish real food security in this country, and then to use that strong evidence to push for that policy. Dr. Valerie Tarasuk has a 30-year history as a professor and now a professor emerita at the University of Toronto and has played a central role in the creation and ongoing work of PROOF as one of its founding investigators. She joins us today to tell us the story of how this all happened and why the work she and others are doing is so important for the future of ordinary Canadians. Valerie, a very warm welcome to Food Conversations.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us from the snows of Toronto in the tiny precipitation of Salmon Arm today, thank heavens. Now, you're still listed as PROOF's principal investigator, but you're now a professor emerita. And I've always wondered what happens when you become a professor emerita or a professor emeritus at a big university like UT. What changes when you are officially redesignated as that new role? What changes?
Well, with that,
if anything,
I forfeit my tenure and my salary, so I transfer into a pension.
Yes.
But what changes in terms of my life is I then no longer have any teaching or administrative responsibilities. The research part of faculty's lives is, at least at the University of Toronto, it's separate, right? Mm-hmm. So at the time that I retired, we still had active funding and we had a project going on and we had an idea for a project beyond that. And so that research work has kept happening. I mean, it won't go on much longer, but I'm, as a professor emerita at the University of Toronto, I continue to be able to hold research funds.
Yes.
And so there are, that component can go on as long as I can.
Yeah. It's a little bit of a liberation in a way, the quotidian tasks that are part of your role.
Yeah.
It's suddenly you're free as a bird. You can say, I got to really pour myself into this stuff. Yeah, I've often thought that it really doesn't mean you stop. It means you let go of some of the daily tasks and you could do the stuff that really matters, that really feels important. Yeah. Now, The name Proof, interesting, is an interesting story, which I'll ask you about in a moment, but it's got a connection to where our studio is, in the Shoe Swap in British Columbia. It was first suggested by Kathleen Neen, and she's, of course, listeners here do know about her as a central figure in Canadian food security advocacy and planning. Well, she lived for a number of years just down the road from Salmon Arm, from our studio, with her husband and daughter and son-in-law, and on a farm near Sorrento, with an organic brewery, which was run by her daughter and son-in-law. And everyone in this region knows about the backhand of God. The backhand of God is a stout that was made in this brewery by her daughter and son-in-law. And so tell the story. That's the local story for Catherine Neen. But she had a big part. Her presence had a big part in this, in the naming of this organization. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell that story? It's a good story.
Well, we when Proof was funded, we had basically were applying for a programmatic grant to do research in the area of policy and food insecurity. And as part of that, we created a kind of advisory group. And at the time, Kathleen Neen, I think, might have been the executive director of Food Secure Canada. Anyway, she was a part of this group. And so we convened these people that were a mixture of kind of what we would have back then called stakeholders, you know, people from a variety of NGOs and related organizations that had an interest in food insecurity and we hoped would help us to refine what we were doing. So we came together, but this was early days, right? We had just received funding and we're starting to kind of organize ourselves.
Right.
And we needed a name. And it was Kathleen that proposed Proof.
How did you do that? Was it a speech and then she just threw it out and everybody said, that's it?
No. It was just like, we were just in, you know, in a room with, sitting around and there was a thinking that we needed a name and she suggested that one because for her, it got at the point of evidence and, you know, we were a very research oriented group and that was the contribution that we could make. So that's how it came about.
Yeah.
So often people have asked us, is it an acronym for something? Well, no, it's not. It's just a word.
I've been dying to ask you that. I had a little question in my notes here saying, does this actually stand for anything? Because so many groups, at one point, years ago, you worked with CUSO, and I'm old enough to remember that CUSO stands for Canadian Union of Students Overseas, but so many organizations don't like to tell the history of their name. They just say, that's who we are. Anyway, before the name and before the entity was created, I love when you said to me, we were talking before the show, you said, I was out in the garden planting tomatoes. And suddenly something happened. So on the way to the third row of tomatoes, what was gestated in your mind out in the garden that led to what later became Proof?
Well, as I described to you in our earlier conversation, the entity came about because of a funding opportunity.
Yes.
Most health research or health-related research in Canada is funded through the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, which is the federal funding arm.
Indeed.
And they had launched a very unusual competition for programmatic funding to do research that would contribute to reducing health inequities.
And this was in 2009, I think.
2009. Yeah. And this was a one-off announcement. And it was a large sum of money over a five-year period. But as researchers, the word programmatic is really important because it offered us an opportunity to do a lot of interrelated thing, whereas normally when we're applying for research funds, it's for a project with a discrete beginning and end.
Yeah.
So there were two stages to the application: first, a letter of intent, but it was a major undertaking to develop this, to pull together a team that would meet those criteria, and then develop the proposal. So there was a weekend. in that spring when my job at home was to plant tomatoes in my garden. I'd kind of set myself the task that I had to make a decision either to go for this proposal because, and start moving so that So by Monday, by the time I went back to work on Monday, I needed to be able to say, okay, we're going for it. And here, you know, now let's get ourselves organized, or, you know, it's too much, or we can't make it. So that was me out in the garden that weekend, thinking about how I could fulfill their criteria, but also what were the, if I were to start with a blank slate, what were the research questions that needed to be addressed related to food insecurity at that time? What were the opportunities for research? And off we went.
I like to think that the tomatoes were your partners in this decision-making process. It appeals to me. Well, simply because you're in the presence of real food. You know, and where does food come? It doesn't come from magic. It comes from work and effort and putting things together. And it's also, this was a bit unusual to have this kind of five-year programmatic approach. That wasn't what the CIHR does normally and what most project support is in the form of. It's not 5 years until you've got your feet on the ground. That must have been quite an inspiration for you and for the others that joined in the group.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it was absolutely wonderful.
Now, on the proof website, there are a couple of statements, and I think if we went and parsed some of the language in it, it would make it really clear to people what's involved. Now, the first is in the section of the proof website that is about, in quotes, and that means, you know, what are we all about? And I think it's a pretty wonderful and clear definition. It says, household foods insecurity, the inadequate or insecure access to food due to financial constraints, is a serious public health problem in Canada. PROOF is an interdisciplinary research program studying effective policy approaches to reduce it. Now, let's just go through that. Okay, the financial constraints. Talk about the financial constraints and how broad and deep they can be.
That language refers to the way that food insecurity is measured and monitored in Canada.
Right.
And that might be a bit of a twist for people. Typically, when you think of problems of food affordability, mm-hmm. the public face of that is food banks, right? Mm-hmm. And we annually, if not more frequently, see reports on the number of Canadians using food banks. And often mm-hmm. that's cited as a metric. But for more than 20 years now, Statistics Canada has been monitoring this problem of people's inability to afford the food they need, mm-hmm. systematically using a very carefully designed set of questions to get at that affordability issue. So the definition of food insecurity that you see on the PROOF website is really a representation of what's being tracked mm-hmm. nationally as it relates to this problem. Why is there this focus on income? It's because the way most Canadians get food is to buy it.
Yes.
And so even if people are growing some of their food, and you know, in most cases that is not happening, but mm-hmm. where it is happening, still, should that food access fail or exhaust itself for whatever reason, mm-hmm. the fallback is to go to a store. So
it was very interesting.
The problem is a lack of money.
Very interesting. During the in BC, we had a lot of highways washed out because of a massive atmospheric river, actually two in a row. And what occurred in this, even this little town here, was that the food shelves went empty. Not all of them, but all of the stuff that wasn't locally produced became invisible. It wasn't there anymore. Mm-hmm. Just to remind listeners, once again, that I'm speaking with Valerie Tarasak, who's a 30-year professor at University of Toronto and one of the founding investigators of the organization, a group called PROOF, looking at food security. Now, the importance of in people's lives of not having enough food or not being able to afford enough food is that it actually affects their health. And the next phrase, the public health problem, a serious public health problem, that linkage is such an important point because it gets to the very personal, very intimate nature of what this problem means. Do you want to flesh out a little bit the dimensions of the kind of health issue there is?
Yeah. For sure, when, you know, if people are unable to afford the food they need, they are making compromises in what they're eating and how much they're eating in some cases. But what we've come to understand is that the measurement of food insecurity, because we're trapping such hardship we're picking up a cascade of problems, one of which is an inability to afford food. But by the time somebody is struggling to put food on the table for themselves and their family because of a lack of money, invariably, they're also struggling to pay their bills, to pay their rent, to make a mortgage payment if they had a mortgage, if they have prescription medications, if there's even so much as a toonie attached to the filling of those prescriptions, they're probably not filling them or taking them as prescribed. You know, they've got children, they're compromising their clothing, you know, recreation, everything. So what we've come to appreciate over the years is that this measure of food insecurity is a very sensitive indicator of material deprivation, more pervasive material deprivation. And so when we look at the health effects of food, or not health effects, but the health correlates of food insecurity, they're broad, right? Yes, absolutely. Canadians in food insecure households are more likely to develop diabetes over time, type 2 diabetes. They're more likely to have mental health problems, but they're also more likely to have a whole raft of chronic and acute conditions. And anything they've got, they're less able to manage. So they're more likely to show up in an emergency department or in a hospital ward because they've derailed. So, you know, if it started out as asthma or arthritis or hypertension, you know, put somebody in the circumstance of struggling to afford basic needs, leave them there for a while, and whatever they've got, it's gotten worse. So that's why we're saying this is a strong public health problem.
Just to remind listeners, once again, that I'm speaking with Valerie Tarasuk, who's a 30-year professor at University of Toronto and one of the founding investigators of the organization, a group called PROOF, looking at food security. Now, one feature of this program that you've developed is that it's interdisciplinary. And to me, everything that we do in life should be interdisciplinary. You know, children just as important for their parents as parents are for their children, and the neighbors are important. It's just the way we live. Talk about how, why that's appealing and why that's important.
Well, to from our goal of understanding how policy relates to food insecurity. So, you know, who is food insecure? Why are they food insecure? What would it take to make them food secure? Right. You know, those are our basic questions. Those are broad questions. And, you know, I was a professor in nutritional sciences. Like, you know, I know a lot about nutritional sciences, or I was trained in nutritional science, but, you know, I actually don't have the skill set to
ask. What about money matters? What about?
To step back and say, what's the effect of the Canada Child Benefit been on this problem? And how could the Canada Child Benefit be tweaked to make it more impactful? So being an interdisciplinary from this project meant linking with people with training in health economics, public policy, policy analysis, public health, so that we had a broader set of skills at the table to interrogate these questions.
And in fact, your appointment is, part of your appointment is in the Faculty of Medicine, or the...
The Nutritional Sciences is housed in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Toronto.
And this allows me to bring up the sad, sad fact that up till now, the medical profession, of which I am a part, has failed to recognize that food is important in health and does not teach nutritional science in medical school. I mean, I know it's coming. We have a group out
I'm not sure. I mean, I certainly have spent many, many hours over my career doing lectures to medical students. And so, I wouldn't say that there's nothing happening. But I worry that now that we have physicians engaged in food insecurity, I worry about where that takes us, because what we've seen is, you know, it moving very quickly into food-based responses. So, you know, food prescribing, referrals to food charities, you know, we've seen quite an engagement, I would argue.
I had the pleasure of introducing, interviewing Annie Lalonde, who's a family, she's actually a surgical resident at the Vancouver General Hospital. And she is part of a group of people who are starting to say the food you present to people in the hospital setting is much better for their health if it's good quality food and tasty, and they like to eat it because they'll actually get better faster. And this group that she's part of talks about the institutional barriers. They're coming down, But the focus in the training program for physicians is still not really caught up to this profound reality that food plays a huge role in human health. Now, one of the things that's also in this description is about the fact that you're looking to create an effective policy, and meaning that it is, or you want to have something that will actually work. If you implement this policy, it won't just be sitting on a dusty shelf or not bringing the things to people that you want to bring to them. What is the key, as you would see it, to having an effective policy?
Well, I think it's, as you said, it's something that will make a difference, right? And in an affluent country like Canada, I think we're looking at two dimensions. One is policy that insulates people from hardship, from food insecurity.
Yes.
What do we have that, you know, so when we look at who's food insecure, it's also important for us to look at who isn't and figure out how come those people aren't, what's protective for them,
right,
that the others don't have, right? So that's part of it. The other part of it, obviously, is to put public dollars into an intervention to reduce food insecurity, which I dearly hope we would. That also requires some accountability, I think. So we want to make sure that what we're proposing is something that will net an effect. But also, I would argue that anything, any policy action at any level of government that is ostensibly about impacting food insecurity, I think there should be evaluation attached to it, because we see an awful lot of talk about this issue at all three levels now, but very little accountability for the impact of the action.
And the key to that, it seems to me, is getting information that is relatively unassailable. In other words, somebody can't come along and say, oh, we started down this road and then we found out that we were going in the wrong direction. That must be a little bit of, I wouldn't say an obsessive concern, but a constant concern to get the facts straight and make them, animate them, make them so that they grab people by the throat, as it were.
I don't think that the reason we have such a big problem of food insecurity in Canada now, I don't think that's because of a lack of unassailable information. Not at all. I mean, Canada has invested a lot in,
yes,
food insecurity monitoring. Yeah. We're the envy of many other affluent countries with the quality of our data. And CIHR, the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, by their investments in programs like PROOF, they've also put a lot of money on the table to understand this problem. So I would say that it's not about a lack of information. And at this stage in the game for me, because as you, right, said, you know, I was out in that tomato patch in 2009, and we're having this conversation in 2025. And, you know, we've done an awful lot of mobilizing the information.
Right.
But we have a higher rate of food insecurity than ever before. I mean, 8.9 million Canadians in our last count.
It is quite astonishing when you think about that. That gap between the evidence and the implementation.
Yeah. And action. Oh, it's huge. Yeah.
Now, one of the things that the other statement, which is from the front page of the PROOF website, says the following. Despite the long history of food banks in Canada, household food insecurity has persisted at high rates. And in fact, if you just pointed out, it's expanding. PROOF's research highlights the need for policymakers to shift their focus from food charity to public policies that increase the incomes of vulnerable households. Now, there's a big mouthful right there of words, not food, unfortunately. Food banks have this gloss of kindness. You know, we're helping these people, these poor people. But it's got to be so inherently discriminatory. And frankly, in my opinion, it's a statement of failure that we haven't developed a system that makes food banks irrelevant or unnecessary. Do you want to talk about food banks and how they've sort of seconded the approval of many people, but how they just don't do the job?
Well, the first food bank appeared in Canada in 1981, right? So we've got a very, very long history of food charity, which is, you know, charitable food assistance as a response to,
right,
this problem. And the scale of the operations, I think, of food charity in Canada now are massive, absolutely
Indeed.
Massive. And while you would say, you know, they're a blight on society, they indicate a failure, and I would agree, but we've got generations of Canadians now that have been raised with this as the norm, right? I don't know what happens in Salmon Arm, but I can tell you in Toronto, it's routine for, you know, children in schools to be encouraged, you know, to bring a donation for a food drive. The opening of the Blue Jays game, every Christmas party, Thanksgiving, whatever, we're inundated with requests for donations. And the messaging and all of that, well, I guess two things to say about it. One, the fact that we have this massive system that is, yes, it's receiving some public funding in some provinces and municipalities, but the backbone of food banks is donations, right? Volunteer labor and donations.
Yes.
And the fact that we could have such a massive system for so long speaks, I think, very strongly to a very fundamental Canadian value. That is, you know, if you tell us there are people in our community who are going hungry, we will do what we can to give them food, right? We'll help them in the way that we can. And this is the way that's been proposed, right?
Yes.
You know, you can make a donation. If you care about this issue,
oh, yeah,
here's what you can do. And Canadians have been doing that in droves for decades now. Okay, yes. But the problem with that is that the immediate relief that's provided, whatever it is, and however big it is, however long it lasts, it does nothing to change the things that are causing somebody.
Agree. This, to your point, this weekend coming up is the coldest night of the year charitable drive, and it's for the hurt, the homeless, and the hungry. That's the tagline for the process, and it goes through our local food bank. It stops at the local food bank, and you get a little drink and a little bit of food, and then you continue on your walk. It's very visible, raises the money that supplies the Shoe Shop Food Action Society with its a very large portion of its annual funding. And yet, as you also pointed out, the food security issue is not going away. It's just not the way to solve the problem. We're going to talk about some solutions in a minute. But it's a shift, as it says here in this commentary, shifting our focus from food charity to increasing the incomes of vulnerable households. Why don't you talk about how central that is to the transformation we need to undertake?
Well, I think, you know, while we and Proof and other groups have continued to chart this problem and to chart its very disturbing associations with health and healthcare utilization, the public face remains this very simple portrayal of people are hungry, donate, give food, and, you know, help end hunger in Toronto, donate, right? Tackling hunger. We've got trucks are driving around the city saying fighting hunger. And like, so this is how you do it.
Yes.
And I think both politicians and the general public have been lulled into thinking that somehow we're managing the problem, you know? And so often you'll hear politicians, if they, you know, speak on this topic, they'll say people shouldn't have to use a food bank, as if, you know, what matters is that they're using a food bank or they're not using a food bank. And we say, no, actually, people shouldn't have to go hungry.
Indeed, indeed.
You know, people shouldn't have trouble affording the food they need.
I want to remind listeners once again that our guest today is Valerie Tarasuk, who's a professor emerita from the University of Toronto and is founding investigator of Proof, a food security advocacy organization. Now, addressing this issue of talk versus action, one of your colleagues and co-investigators in Proof, Dr. Daniel Dawson from Dalhousie University, he's part of an aging research group there, and there's a comment on that group's website. It says, and I almost had a heart attack when I read this, "We know that it takes, on average, 17 years for research to be translated into action." Please tell me you have an emotional response to that statement.
Yeah. Well, part of me thinks only 17. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But what do you actually see when you've produced documentation? Proof has produced lots of high quality evidence. What path does that evidence follow, and into what empty space does it land, and what minds does it activate?
It's difficult to see. I mean, we can see some, we can see some indications. Like, this is such a big problem. And to give you a positive example, I guess, a few years ago, an MLA in Prince Edward Island put forward a bill in the legislature there to set measurable targets for the province to reduce poverty and food insecurity. And it was just a fluky thing, right? That this, her name was Hannah Bell, and she put forward this motion. And, you know, who would vote against the idea that they wanted less poverty and food insecurity? And there were particular targets related to children's experiences of poverty and food insecurity built into the motion, and it passed. And so Prince Edward Island became the first province in Canada to commit to reducing this problem. And it's been really, really interesting to see where that's gone. It's only been a few years, and I'm sorry I can't tell you the exact year that Hannah Bell's motion went forward, but it's not long. But we were recently in conversation with folks in Prince Edward Island, because by virtue of that motion, we've got civil servants now in Prince Edward Island who are compelled to report regularly on progress. Right. And start to really take a good hard look at their toolkit and say, what can we do? We've also seen, I think, really, really exciting developments in the province of Newfoundland and Labrador. Similarly, with both politicians and senior level bureaucrats trying to think long and hard about what could the province do to get their numbers down. And again, how do we evaluate that? How do we see, you know, how do we monitor those trends? Now, I mean, those are two examples of where I feel like our research has hit a chord, and the management of this problem has now been taken out of the charitable domain and is now sitting where it belongs, which is in social services.
Yes.
So that's been really nice to see, but those are two small victories, I think.
And that's a first step in a chain of processes, because I've been aware for a number of years. I remember when I first was involved in any kind of advocacy work, when you got a law to be passed or an act of parliament to take place, it was like, oh, we've got a victory.
Yeah.
And then I discovered that the first pesticide abatement law in Canada had been sitting on the books for something like 12 years before actually it was implemented, before regulatory provisions were introduced that actually made it do something as opposed to just sitting on the books. Do you see, I mean, what you've described in Prince Edward Island and Newfoundland was an important step forward. It's like opening the door, but walking through that door sometimes takes political actors a very long time. What's that like, watching that process?
Well, I mean, I'm happy that there's even a conversation about it. But one of the things that is tricky with food insecurity, and I think with managing problems like this or addressing them in Canada, is complicated because of the division of responsibility between the province and the federal government. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was tough having conversations with people in Prince Edward Island and saying, you know, there's only so much you're going to be able to do. There needs to be another partner at the table. Mm-hmm. And so we really need provinces to be asking for a different kind of response, I think, federally as well. But yeah, I mean, it's complicated, but it's good that this is the beginning, right? This is where change happens.
A lot of people are saying that what we need in the world is not more evidence. We need more dialogue, and dialogue meaning people talking to each other who don't normally talk to each other, people who are living in certain circumstances, talking to people who are not living those circumstances, right. And especially the people who are marginalized. They have the most to tell us about what's really going on in the world. Now, just to switch gears a little bit here, because the whole enterprise of proof is not, as they say, your first rodeo. You have a host of academic qualifications that you've gathered over the years. Bachelor of Arts, Bachelor of Education, Bachelor of Applied Science, then a master's degree and a doctorate in nutritional sciences. My goodness, you should be prime minister right now. But actually, at the very beginning, you were actually thinking of going into medicine, which makes it easy to be in the faculty of medicine. It's just like coming home in a way. But that was after you'd spent 3 years in Papua New Guinea in the late 70s, teaching, of all things, mathematics, which isn't the thing that people think you go to Papua New Guinea to do for, with CUSO, the Canadian Union of Students Overseas. How did that experience shape your view of yourself and the world and your role in it? Obviously, you had other experiences before that, but what did that do in terms of pushing you or pulling you?
Well, it was a very rich experience to be working in a place like the highlands of Papua New Guinea. As a young person, it was an amazing experience. For me, heaven only knows what any of us in CUSO contributed to the places we went to, but I returned from Papua New Guinea with the idea that I would pick up courses and apply to medicine, thinking that, having figured out that I did not want to spend my life as a school teacher, but also that, perhaps I could make a difference in primary health, or in primary health care.
Right.
That was kind of the beginning of me going back to school, and then figuring out that, perhaps a better niche for me was nutrition and nutrition research.
Of course, you went into the lion's den. You went to Guelph University. If there is a university in Canada that has anything to do with food and agriculture and that sort of thing, that's the place, and began working towards a Bachelor of Applied Science. But I gather in your mind, you were telling me earlier, it was a stepping stone. You were gathering this sort of science stuff so that you could go into medicine. And then something happened on the way to the forum. Going into medicine didn't seem... What changed for you?
Well, I think I was just really enjoying... I don't think I had understood how much I would enjoy applied sciences. And I think the applied piece of that was huge for me. And so I was just really enjoying the things I was learning in the courses I was taking at Guelph.
What does applied mean in that context? I mean, it's an interesting word to have in an academic setting. You apply things. What did it mean?
Well, I remember taking a course, a biochemistry course, which was, a required thing. Mm. But it was called biochemistry. I wasn't taking a pure chemistry course, right? It was biochemistry. Mm. And it was a summer course, and it was in this basement. And I remember this man talking about trans fat and, introducing us to the chemical structure of trans versus cis bonds and, what those were. And it was fascinating because, trans fats were in hydrogenated oil. So
Indeed. At
that time in Canada, margarine was very common, and hydrogenated oil, hydrogenated margarines were very, very common.
Yes.
And, both in households, but also in institutional settings and food processing, there was a lot of hydrogenation.
And they used to put the dye in a separate container, and you were supposed to mix the yellow color in.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah,
it looked absolutely gross.
To make it look like more like butter. But I'm sitting in this basement learning biochemistry, but then we're talking about trans fats, and somebody's, this guy, this prof, is making the link to margarine. Mm. And then he's explaining to us, even back then, he's explaining to us what the difference was with Bacel, because at that point, that was a relatively new product in the system, and it wasn't hydrogenated. It was fascinating. So, sometime after that, I did, as a course assignment, I needed to choose a paper topic, and I did a paper doing, so that it gave me the opportunity to explore the research on trans fats and health through a nutrition lens in another course.
Yes.
But that's an example, of what, for me, in applied sciences was so interesting, that you weren't just learning kind of technical things, but that there was a real-life application.
Yeah.
A way in which you also had an appreciation of things being dynamic, right? That this was a relatively new industrial, you know, a feature of our industrialized food supply. And then, you know, what did it mean in terms of health and nutrition was, you know, years to come before that was really clear. And now trans fats have been taken off the shelf, right? Because it's been recognized that they're not good for us.
Yeah, I was going to say, I bet you don't use margarine when you're eating the tomatoes that you grew in your garden.
Now, well, if I do, it's not hydrogenated. Sure.
But there's another side of this, and there's another current in your life, and that was in your own family. You grew up in a military family. You traveled from place to place. Your family moved from place to place. And the words you used to describe your parents were the words empathetic and compassionate. Now, for many people, they don't have a vision of a military base as a hotbed of empathy and compassion, but your parents were special in that way, it seems to me. Maybe there are far more military people who are empathetic and compassionate on military.
I think there are. I mean, I absolutely think there are. Yeah. It's interesting to me that you would very quickly see that as a disconnect with the notion of military.
Well, but no, I didn't. You know, I actually introduced it as a conventional thinking. Yes.
people having to work together and you know, work together effectively. And I think that very quickly comes to empathy and compassion.
Well, the other thing is that in the military, people know what it's like if there is an actual physical altercation. It usually means somebody's going to get hurt. And as a military, not in peacetime, hopefully, but there's this notion that you know what happens when conflict arises and you're there in the middle of it and your potential to be injured is great. I remember at a peace conference, he was a major in the Canadian Army, said, "I represent the largest peace group in this country, because we know what war is like, and war is hell, and don't anybody think any, and we know." But at any rate, you also had a strong sense of independence, and moving a lot does something to one's sort of social matrix, because it's shifting all the time. So you kind of have to develop skills that allow you to be in places where you're not familiar with all the parameters, but you find a way in. That must have stood you in good stead over the years, that capacity to go here, there, and make yourself sort of at home.
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's all I've ever known. So, yeah.
But I'm sure you see people who haven't had that experience, and they walk into a room and they're terrified and they don't know what to say. I mean, there are lots of people who are very good at, say, research behind the scenes, but when they get into a public setting, they're not quite sure what to do. Well, I'll tell you, every part of our conversation before and during this show has shown that you really do have exceptional social skills, and I would attribute it to your constant moving in a military family. I remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Valerie Tarasuk, who's a professor emerita from U of T and one of the founding investigators for the PROOF program on food security. Valerie, why don't we talk about the nub of the matter, or something one could really consider the nub of the matter, and that is turning compassion and social responsibility into concrete form. And we talked briefly about one of my modest obsessions, which is a guaranteed basic income or an equivalent. Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, Rebecca Neen and her husband, Brian McIsaac, who run the brewery that makes the Backhand of God down the road, we had a discussion when they were interviewed recently on Food Conversations, and it was around whether a guaranteed basic income was better, or guaranteeing sort of like a chit to make sure you had a reasonable place to live and enough to buy proper food. Now, I'd be grateful if you'd share your perspective on this, because you've sat in the core of this: what policy works, what would be better, what can make a difference, really make a difference. Why don't you talk about that and your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's great that we're at a time in Canada where we're even having this conversation about a guaranteed basic income. From the food insecurity perspective, I said earlier that, you know, it's been 20 years since we have been monitoring this. We started measuring back in the mid-90s. So this, we've had, you know, data population survey data on food insecurity for a very long time in this country. One of the things that has been evident since the 90s, when we run analysis of who's food insecure and who isn't, or, you know, what are the predictors of food insecurity, from the 90s, one characteristic has appeared as protective repeatedly in analysis, and that's being a senior or being on a senior's pension. And that, like I say, the first time we saw that in an analysis was working with data from the mid-90s. We can see it today in 2025 as well. So when proof got established, one of the things that happened, and not from me, but colleagues in proof, Herb Emery and Lynn McIntyre and Dan Dutton that you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. from Dalhousie University, they did a number of pieces of work to try to understand what is it about old age security and the guaranteed income supplement. How do they function in relationship to food insecurity? And it was absolutely fascinating to see the effect. Now, I should have backed up a little bit. The reason I'm talking about old age security and the guaranteed income supplement, these are public pensions that are available to all Canadians are entitled to at the point that they hit 65. Indeed. And if they're low income, they receive this guaranteed income supplement on top of the OAS. So it's effectively a guaranteed annual income for seniors.
Right.
And Canada's had this for years and years and years, and instituted as a way to insulate seniors from poverty. A very laudable goal, right? Yeah. So then we start looking at it through the lens of food insecurity. And what we can see is when people turn 65, Lynn and McIntyre and Herb Emery and Dan Dutton did a study looking at low-income individuals and unattached individuals with very low incomes, looking at their probability of food insecurity in their 50s, 60s, 70s, onward, right? Mm-hmm. What they found is that at the point that these people turn 65, their probability of being food insecure dropped in half.
Yes.
Now, they were all very low-income people. Before they hit 65, their incomes were primarily social assistance or low-wage employment. Now at 65, suddenly they've got a secure income floor that is indexed to inflation. It comes with full pharmacare, which some of those people wouldn't have had before. And on top of that, we've got the private sector doing, senior shopping days and, you know, Walmart, you know, seniors yep. days at the Bay or wherever you are. So it's for us in proof, it's been a very, very powerful piece of evidence to say that, you know, a guaranteed annual income, both because of the adequacy of it, but also the predictability, the stability.
Yes, it's a predictability. It's there for everybody. Yeah,
those two things together, you know, are part of the fabric of a social program that insulates people from food insecurity.
So. I have to bring up the fact that there was a guaranteed basic income program in Ontario for several years, and then it was trashed by your premier, Mr. Ford. I've seen some of the preliminary evidence because McMaster University was asked to do a survey of results, and the results were stupendous. Something like 85% of people who were involved in the program had an enormous improvement in their basic state of mind. In other words, they stopped feeling constantly harried, depressed, isolated, lost. Stories of young men, for example, who don't get a lot of support from the pre-pension world, suddenly they're going back to school and starting to say, I have a life now. I can start doing things for myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
That sounds like what we're talking about. What does it feel like for you when you know all this, when you know this from oodles of evidence? What's it like to see something brought forward, handed to the population in a pilot project, albeit, and then withdrawn again with no regard for the evidence base that is looming in the core of this program?
Well, I mean, I'm, I, there are things that bothered me more than the cancellation of the basic income pilot, because as you say, it was a pilot and it was a small thing. It was a long way from a thoughtful, you know, social policy.
Yes.
And even in its design, it was very unclear, I think, how it was going to inform subsequent action of the government. But still, it was very disappointing to see that that experiment terminated as rapidly as it was by the current government.
And every experiment like that around the world, Finland, Manitoba, has shown the same thing. It's so crystal clear. Yeah. It's like, how do you avoid seeing this?
So we almost, this is a place where we almost don't need more research. It's really about figuring out.
Well, I would say,
The political will and the way to get people on board. Because, you know, the flip side of this is a politician making a remark about, you know, paying people to sit at home drinking beer and watching television or something, right? And so, and, you know, the other side of this is constant. And and I think there have been people doing costing exercises saying, oh, you know, we can't possibly afford this. So, yeah, it's that conversation that needs to carry on more so than I think the evidence that, for sure, if people have adequate, stable incomes, their chances of being food insecure are very low. But sadly, with the fragmented social safety net we've got right now and the lack of accountability for adequacy or stability in that safety net, we've got, and especially in the context of the current food price inflation and, you know, inflation and other basic needs, we've got a real problem on our hands.
Indeed. And in fact, we talked about that before the show, the having either a piecemeal, fragmented bits and pieces, Band-Aids all over the place, or having a holistic or integrated approach where there's a fundamental core baseline that is not negotiable or not, you can't play with it.
Yeah.
That seems to me central to what the work you've been doing is all about.
Yeah. I would say it absolutely is, that we can talk, and I do both things, right? I mean, we can talk about basic income and the importance of it and the evidence, you know, from our look at seniors to say, you know, we know this is an effective way to insulate people. But then if there's no appetite for that, then let's go back to talking about social assistance programs that are managed provincially. Let's look at the Canada Child Benefit, employment insurance, the Canada Worker Benefit. Like, these are all the building blocks of an income floor that if we're not going to do it wholeheartedly, then we've got to work on these pieces and negotiate or, you know, advocate with the gatekeepers in each one of those little compartments.
You know, it's such a seems such a failure of thought to have all these little bits and pieces. It's almost like nobody wants to say, let's be really nice to everybody on a constant basis. It's more like, well, I'll be nice to these people because they got a big problem and those people have another problem.
But it's also, nobody wants to take responsibility for this problem, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm in Toronto, Ontario's having an election. before this call, I went and voted at the advance polls. But if you watch the, many provinces have had elections recently or are having them. If you watch the conversations that are happening there, these kinds of issues are not on the table. And that's part of the challenge here, right? That nobody's really, and I appreciate that with the change in government in the United States, things have really become quite chaotic.
Yes.
But we've got this ongoing storyline that isn't going to go away, that we've had for a long time. It predates Trump for sure.
Oh, absolutely. No.
And it's not something that is front and center in our political realm, federally or provincially. And I think that's part of our problem.
Well, one of the things is that it's only 20 or so years ago that the book was apparently written on saying that Western liberal democracy, which is fundamentally rooted in capitalism, is the best way for the world to run itself and everybody should be doing it. And yet now we're seeing at least an ecological level, we're seeing danger signs everywhere that this system promulgates. And what we're talking about here would be interpreted south of the border as well nigh talking about communism. The idea that, from each from his capacity to each according to his need, which actually is very close to some statements in the Christian Bible. Almost exactly the same thing, those statements can be found there. I think, do you see the pace of change as a sort of final question, because we're nearing the end of the show. Do you see the pace of change picking up?
Yes, I guess I do.
That was a long pause, Valerie.
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking, is it picking up? Yes. I mean, things are changing all the time. That's for sure.
Yes.
Are they changing in the directions I'd want them to? Well, most of the time not. But yeah.
I honestly see Donald Trump south of the border as an unavoidable lesson in the dangers of, as you described it, chaotic, unthought through policy making at a high level. It produces nothing but pain and suffering and confusion. You know, in your guest profile before that Tom, our engineer, sent out to you, you said something, and I think you've given abundant evidence for it. You said, "I am passionate about our work, and that will come through very quickly in our interview." Valerie, you are passionate about your work, and I'm glad you're passionate about your work, because it's really central to creating a civilized society. And I just want to thank you for being on the show. It's really been a delight to have you here and to hear what you have to say. And perhaps one day we'll have you back to talk about in full force the redistribution of income and some guarantees that we need in a democracy. Thank you very much for being on the show today. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.
It's been a delight.